Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to another edition of From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we come with a quick, clean program on Howard Zinn. Our co-producer and mixer, Mark Torres, has been ill this week, so we're putting a self-contained 59-minute speech of Howard Zinn, Virtual Optimism, the Other Side of American History.
And there was a guy named Charles Hutto who actually participated in the massacre years later. Well, he said, I was 19 years old, and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons, if the government calls, to use their own judgment, to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should be even a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind.
Here it says this was from November 1992, so this is 20 years old. Noted social historian Howard Zinn presents an informal talk about United States history from the bottom up. His personal view of history changed following his experiences during the Vietnam War, and he had become interested in the causes of war, the nature of enemy soldiers, the laborers who built the railroads, factory laborers, the poor, and the unrepresented. We pause to remember Howard Zinn, who passed away January 27, 2010, and was a great friend of the Pacifica Radio Archives. And what better way to go through our Memorial Day weekend but to get a history lesson from the man who wrote The People's History of the United States? Here is Howard Zinn.
I didn't go into history just because it was interesting. You know, history is interesting. Everybody knows that. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. History is boring, too. It depends, right? But history can be interesting. But I didn't go into history just because it was interesting, you know, doing investigative work and digging in the archives and finding old letters and, you know, all that stuff that historians do, which is fun. But I didn't go into it for that reason, because it was fun. I didn't start studying history until I had done these other things, you know, until I had, you know, worked in a shipyard for 3 years and been in the Air Force and knocked around at various jobs. And so, you know, I became a freshman in college at the age of 27. I was married and we had children, and I say that to impress you with the weight of my experience. And so by the time I started studying history, I knew why I wanted to study it, and it was not just because it was interesting. I didn't want to simply do as I had seen historians do, that is, sort of go into the past, you know, and never come out. You know, and it's easy to do that, you know. It's interesting there. Why leave? I wanted to go into the past. I was interested in history, but I wanted to come out and see what was going on in the world and connect what I was learning about the past with what was happening. Because of my growing up, I was interested in why some people were rich and some people were poor. My father worked very, very hard and had little to show for it. And I wanted to be able to understand that, you know. Ever since that day, I've always really terribly resented it when somebody would say, well, you know, in America, if you work hard, you know, you've heard that before, you know, you will make it. And if you haven't made it, it must mean you haven't worked hard. I wanted to learn more about the class nature of American society. I always hesitate before I use the word class, you know, because it's a very dangerous word to use. And all the politicians always telling us, let's not arouse class hatred. I was aroused that way when I was very young, and I haven't been able to get over it since. you see. But I was interested in war and what happens in war and why wars take place and what in the world good are they. And so I wanted the answers to some of these questions, you know, when I began to study history. And it occurred to me, you know, how undemocratic this history was and how odd it was that here in this presumably democratic country that our history was so undemocratic, that our history was a history of elites, and that the people were left out of the history. And in some way there was some connection between an undemocratic history and an undemocratic society, because if you generation after generation reproduce an undemocratic history, a history that concentrates on what, you know, the great white men do at the top, then what you do is produce generation after generation a passive citizenry, a citizenry that expects that all the important decisions in society are going to be made by the President of the United States and the Congress and the Supreme Court, and that therefore the only thing that citizens have to do is to go to the polls every 2 or 4 years. The supreme act of citizenship is to go to the polls every 2 or 4 years, to go into that little booth and relieve yourself, you know. Something, you know, that seemed to me fundamentally undemocratic about that. And then I remember, reading something by George Orwell, which epitomized that. Orwell said that whoever controls the past controls the future. And whoever controls the present controls the past. So whoever is in charge of our society can decide what our history will look like. And by deciding what our history will look like, they will decide our future. Well, that made history very important to me, because it meant that history was not disengaged from society, that to create a more democratic history meant that you were at least playing some part in trying to create a more democratic society. So I found I had to read history on my own, and this is what most people find, that they learn more when they get out of class, right? You learn more when you start reading on your own. And so I started reading labor history, because I had been, at the age of 18, I was a member of the Industrial Union of Marine and Shipbuilding Workers of America, which we called UMSWA, which sounds like an Indian name, but actually it's just one of those, you know, union names, which, you know, unions were never good at, you know, PR. So I was interested in labor history, and I got interested in, and that set me on the road to sort of learning about that history that I hadn't learned about in school. Brought me into contact with all sorts of people and all sorts of events that were missing from the textbooks. There was nothing in the textbooks about Mother Jones. I encountered her when I, not in person, I mean, a lot of people are very suspicious when I say, you know, things like that, and they look at me and, yeah, I guess he did. But no, I encountered her when I read about, for the first time, about the Colorado coal strike of 1913-1914 and the Ludlow Massacre, all of that. Things are absolutely absent from my historical training. And I had gone right through the PhD in history. I mean, how much higher can you go than that? but nothing about Mother Jones, and nothing about the Colorado coal strike, and very little about the IWW. And so I was very interested in the fact that workers had to do what was done in Colorado and what was done in so many other places, what was done in Lawrence in 1912 and in on the railroads again and again in the 1890s. And, they had to go out on strike in order to secure some modicum of improvement in their working conditions, because there was all this emphasis on laws passed by Congress, the Constitution of the United States, that bulwark of democracy, the thing which we celebrate and celebrate and celebrate. But the Constitution, the President, the Congress, the Supreme Court, they were not there when workers had to cut down their hours from 16 hours to 12 hours to 10 hours to 8 hours. There's nothing in the Constitution, nothing in the institutions of this presumably democratic country that enabled workers to do away with a 16-hour day. They had to do that on their own. Sure, there's the Bill of Rights, which gave certain, you know, political rights and certain, you know, all know about that, freedom of speech and press. Well, that's another story. A very complicated story. But nothing in the Constitution about economic rights. Well, it teaches you something about the value of institutions and the importance of the powers up there in Washington to see that when it comes to something as crucial as the most elementary biological needs of working people, of how hard they work, how long they work, what conditions they work under, what wages they get, that they're on their own. So the institutions of the country aren't there for them. They have to do it for themselves. That's a very, very important lesson in history. My first teaching job, well, my first real teaching job, I had a few unreal teaching jobs. My first real teaching job was in Atlanta, Georgia, Spelman College, College for Black Women. That time they called it a Negro College. I guess they still do, United Negro College Fund and all of that. And I taught there for 7 years. And that was interesting for me and useful for me in the development of my approach to history, because, you can't live in a black community for 7 years, and certainly not in the midst of the years of the civil rights movement, and come away looking at history the way you did before. And then you realize that history to black people looks different than history to white people, just as history to women looks different than history to men, and history to Native Americans look, you know, right? History looks different. I wanted to write about the Mexican War, not from the standpoint of General Winfield Scott and his triumphant march into Mexico City, but from the standpoint of the soldiers who had volunteered for the Mexican War, not volunteered because they knew what the war was about, volunteered for the same reason the most poor kids volunteer for the military, out of desperation with their lives, out of chance to make something of their lives, and about what was their viewpoint. Well, you know, they're the ones who were with Winfield Scott on the march towards Mexico City, the culmination of the war, and then on the road to Mexico City, 7 regiments of them deserted and went back home. I wanted to tell the story of the Mexican War from the standpoint of the Massachusetts volunteers. Again, the word volunteer always has to be in quotation marks. Who came back from the war. Well, half of them came back alive and attended a dinner in their honor. And their commanding officer got up to speak, and they booed him off the platform, you see. And I wanted to tell the story of wars from the standpoint of the enemy, the other side. Well, that's something new. Yeah, let's look at war from the other side. Let's see how the Mexican War looks to the Mexicans. Let's see how they feel about us taking 40% of their territory. I wanted to tell the story of American industrial progress, not in the way I had learned it, that I had learned it as a great triumph. That period between the Civil War and World War I, the period of when the United States became a great industrial power, and I remember being excited by that as a high school kid. What a wonderful time it was. We became a great and prosperous nation. And all those railroad tracks were laid, and all those steel mills went up, and the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific joined, and we had the Transcontinental Railroad, and the president drove the Golden Spike in, and wow, what a moment. I still remember that Hollywood made a film called Union Pacific about that, you know, and there were these two railroad lines moving closer. You can imagine the suspense building up. Will they really meet? No. And of course, that's in the background. In the foreground, there's a man and a woman moving close, right? But I wanted to tell the story of this great industrial progress from the standpoint of the people who worked on those railroads, the Chinese and Irish immigrants who worked in the heat and in the cold on those railroads and died by the thousands working on those railroads, the people who worked in Rockefeller's oil refineries, the girls who went to work in the textile mills of New England at the age of 11 and died at the age of 25. That was a different story than the story of exultant progress, of industrial civilization. And it made me think about how much the progress of the human race has been measured in quantities of steel ingots and miles of railroad tracks laid without any consideration for what happened to human beings in the course of this so-called progress. That was a different way of, you know, looking at history. And I wanted to tell the story of how people had fought back against this, because I didn't want to see that. When you looked into it, people were not simply passive recipients of all of this. They struggled, they fought back, they resisted. Because it was interesting to me that, you know, despite the great odds, people resisted and resisted and resisted. The Indians, fighting against tremendous odds, resisted. The Seminole Indians of Florida fought for years and years and years before they were subdued. The Indians on the Great Plains, against tremendous odds, against all these modern weapons of the United States Army. Working people resisted their conditions. Well, right from the beginning of the colonial period, there were strikes. Black slaves resisted and revolted again and again. The colonial period, the period before the American Revolution, was full of class conflict, full of tenants rebelling against their landlords, of working people during the revolution asking the question, what are we going to get out of this revolution, and why are we being conscripted to fight against the English when the rich can pay their way? This was not just true of the Civil War, it was true of the Revolutionary War. The rich could pay their way out of the military service. And there were draft riots against this during the Revolutionary War. I was encouraged to see how much resistance there was. See what spunk people had and what courage people had. And recalled to me just things that I had seen myself when in the South during the years of the Civil Rights Movement, the remarkable courage of people under murderous conditions. I mean, what could be more murderous than Mississippi in the early 1960s? But I remember a black Mississippian named Sam Block, who was one of the everybody who was in SNCC and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South knew him, he went with somebody to register them to vote in Greenwood, Mississippi. And to try to register a black person to vote in Greenwood, Mississippi was a very, very daring act, imagine daring act to register to vote in a country that had passed the 15th Amendment almost 100 years ago, and where presumably the great federal government of the United States stood sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and yet it was an act of ultimate courage to try to register somebody to vote in Mississippi. And so the sheriff confronted Sam Block, and somebody standing by sort of made note on their conversation. The sheriff to Sam Block, "Nigger, where you from?" Block, "I'm a native of Mississippi." Sheriff, "I know all the niggers here." Sam Block, "Do you know any colored people?" The sheriff spits on him. The sheriff, "I'll give you till tomorrow to get out of here." Sam Block, "If you don't want to see me here, you better pack up and leave, because I'll be here." I think of all the people who, protested against war, in every war that the United States has fought has had protesters against that war. I remember reading about Helen Keller protesting against World War I. Again, in school, what had I learned about Helen Keller in school in my history books? Now that she was this, this brave kid who overcame her handicaps and learned all these languages, and how nice it was that she was able to do that. But they never told me in school that she was a radical, that she was a socialist, that she was a picketer and a demonstrator. She made a speech at Carnegie Hall just before the United States entered the European War, World War I. She said, "Strike against war, for without you no battles can be fought. Strike against manufacturing shrapnel and gas bombs and all other tools of murder. Strike against preparedness that means death and misery to millions of human beings. Be not dumb, obedient slaves in an army of destruction. Be heroes in an army of construction." Or Mark Twain, speaking out on the Philippine War in the early part of the 20th century. What do you learn about Mark Twain in school? Well, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and yes, a great literary figure. But Mark Twain was an eloquent critic of what the United States was doing abroad. And he commented on the Philippine War, "We have pacified some thousands of the islanders and buried them, destroyed their fields, burned their villages, and turned their widows and orphans out of doors, furnished heartbreak by exile to some dozens of disagreeable patriots, subjugated the remaining 10 millions by benevolent assimilation, which is the pious new name of the musket, We have acquired property in the 300 concubines and other slaves of our business partner and hoisted our protecting flag over that swag. And so, by these providences of God, and the phrase is the government's, not mine, we are a world power. And I've always been especially interested in GIs who protested against war, whether they deserted or whether they had second thoughts about war, as I did, because I was an eager bombardier when I was in the Air Force. And it was only after the war that I began to think about what I had done and the bombs I had dropped and where they had fallen and who the victims were and what all that was about. I read about the My Lai massacre, that sort of pinnacle of atrocities in the Vietnam War, but representing many others, you see. But there were people there who had second thoughts. There were people who at the time refused to participate. We know about Callie and the others, but there were GIs who refused to participate in that. And then there was the warrant officer who flew his helicopter down and tried to stop what was going on. And there was a guy named Charles Hutto who actually participated in the massacre and years later said, I was 19 years old and I'd always been told to do what the grown-ups told me to do. But now I'll tell my sons, if the government calls, to use their own judgment, to forget about authority, to use their own conscience. I wish somebody had told me that before I went to Vietnam. I didn't know. Now I don't think there should be even a thing called war, because it messes up a person's mind. Now, maybe there's something wrong with me, that I'm always looking in history for acts of rebellion and resistance and indignation and dissent, you see. But I look for them because they're the things that are left out of history. And they're real, they're there. And they, even if they represent a small part of what happens in any historical event, it seems to me in some way they represent the essence of it because they represent the future. They represent something that will grow and not, decrease. Carter, after the Russians invaded Afghanistan, invoked the draft again. Some of you may remember that. Registration for the draft. About 10% of those who were supposed to register did not register. That was about 800,000 people. And somebody wrote a letter. A woman. 36 years ago, I stood in front of the crematorium. The ugliest force in the world had promised itself that I should be removed from the cycle of life. I survived the great guns, and with every smile of my son, they grow smaller. It is not for me, sir, to offer my son's blood as lubricant for the next generation of guns. I remove myself and my own from the cycle of death. It's interesting that when Reagan came into office in 1981, he hesitated to resume draft registration. I don't know how many of you remember that. Reagan hesitated to resume draft registration. And this was explained by Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger. Quote, President Reagan believes that resuming the draft to meet manpower problems would lead to public unrest comparable to that in the 60s and 70s. There was an editor of the National Review who was terribly distressed at the fact that young people were not rushing to register for the draft unanimously. And he was convinced that it was the fault of the 60s. And he said, almost certainly, he was talking about a young man named Benjamin Sassway. Sassway refused to register, and he cited U.S. military intervention in El Salvador as a good reason not to register. And so he became a sort of public case. And this editor of the National Review wrote, "Almost certainly there was a teacher or teachers who taught Benjamin Sassway to look at American society as hypocritical, exploitative, materialistic roadblock on the path of human progress." I was very happy to read that. I was also interested in the fact that in the 80s, now I was teaching in the 80s, and everybody was saying, or a lot of people were saying, the Reagan years and student generation, quiet, it's not like the 60s, you know, the students are passive, the students are not. Well, they were judging the 80s by what they were reading in the newspapers. It's amazing how the press can create, just like they can give labels to eras, they can also give descriptions of whole blocks of people, which then become self-fulfilling prophecies, or which they hope will become self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, it's a silent generation again. We're back to the 50s. Students aren't interested. I just never found that to be true. And I wasn't teaching little seminars of radical kids. I was teaching a course every semester with 400 students of all sorts, engineering students and business students and hockey players. And I didn't find that at all. I found that my students were interested in what was going on in the world, cared about what was going on in the world, didn't find the wherewithal, they didn't find some great issue going on. There was no civil rights movement, there was no Vietnam War, but when Central American issues came up, yes, they got active on Central America. And you remember, there were things that went on hundreds of campuses all over the country on Central America, on divestment from South Africa, and so on. And my students would write, they would keep journals in my class and to express their thoughts on whatever we were discussing in class. And it was interesting to me to read these journals after reading the descriptions of this passive generation in the Time magazine. This was a woman who was a photojournalism student. She says, "We seem to compare wars like we do wine. 1776 was a good year, and 1898 was a bad year. And World War II seemed to be the Dom Perignon of wars. But in the nuclear age, war can no longer be compared to wine, but to cyanide. One sip and you're dead." Another student, biology major, "Do you think anything good that has happened in the world has had anything to do with government?" "I work in Roxbury." That's a black neighborhood in Boston. "I know the government doesn't work. Not for the people of Roxbury. Not for the people anywhere. It works for people with money." Young woman, "As a white middle-class person, I've never felt discriminated against, but I'll say this. If anyone ever tried to make me sit in a different schoolroom, use a different bathroom, or anything like that, I would knock them right on their ass." I mean, I marked her down, of course, for language, you know. I mean, that's really intolerable.
You are listening to the Pacifica Radio Archives hero Howard Zinn on From the Vault. For more information about this program or other materials in our archive of Howard Zinn, please contact us at 1-800 735-0230, or you can go online at fromthevaultradio.org, and you can also search our collection at pacificaradioarchives.org.